Chapter 6. Good Sir. Latitude 74 degrees, 43 minutes, 28 seconds north. Longitude 90 degrees, 39 minutes, 15 seconds west. Beachy Island, winter, 1845 to 46. From the private diary of Dr. Harry D. S. Goodsir.
1 January, 1846. John Torrington, stoker on HMS Terra, died early this morning. New Year's Day, the beginning of our fifth month stuck in the ice here at Beachy Island. His death was not a surprise. It has been obvious for several months that Torrington had been in the advanced stages of consumption when he signed on the expedition, and if the symptoms had manifested themselves just a few weeks earlier in the late summer, he would have been sent home on Rattler, or even with the two whaling ships we encountered just before sailing west across Baffin Bay and through Lancaster Sound to the Arctic Waste, where we now find ourselves wintering. The sad irony is that Torrington's doctor had told him that going to sea would be good for his health. Chief Surgeon Peddy and Dr. MacDonald on Terra treated Torrington, of course, but I was present several times during the diagnosis stage and was escorted to their ship by several of Erebus's crewmen after the young stoker died this morning. When his illness became obvious in early November, Captain Crozier relieved the 20-year-old of his duties as stoker down in the poorly ventilated lowest deck. The coal dust in the air alone there is enough to asphyxiate a person with normal lungs, and John Torrington had been in a consumptive invalid's downward spiral since then. Still, Torrington might have survived for many more months had not there been an intermediating agent of his death. Dr. Alexander MacDonald tells me that Torrington, who had become too weak in recent weeks even to allow his short constitutionals around the lower deck, helped by his messmates, came down with pneumonia on Christmas Day, and it had been a death watch since then. When I saw the body this morning, I was shocked at how emaciated the dead John Torrington was, but both Peddy and MacDonald explained that his appetite had been waning for 2 months, and even though the ship's surgeons altered his diet more heavily toward canned soups and vegetables, he had continued to lose weight. This morning I watched as Peddy and MacDonald prepared the corpse, Torrington in a clean striped shirt, his hair recently and carefully cut, his nails clean, binding the usual clean cloth around his head to keep the jaw from dropping, then binding him with more strips of white cotton at the elbows, hands, ankles, and big toes. They did this in order to hold the limbs together while they weighed the poor boy, 88 pounds, and otherwise prepared his body for burial. There was no discussion of post-mortem examination, since it was obvious that consumption, accelerated by pneumonia, had killed the lad, so there was no worry of contamination reaching other crew members. I helped my two surgeon colleagues from HMS Terra lift Torrington's body into the coffin carefully prepared for it by the ship's able carpenter, Thomas Honey, and by his mate, a man named Wilson. There was no rigor mortis. The carpenters had left a residue of wood shavings along the bottom of the coffin, so carefully constructed and shaped out of standard ship's mahogany, with a deeper pile of shavings under Torrington's head. And because there was yet little scent of decay, the air was scented primarily by the wood shavings. 3 January, 1846. I keep thinking about John Torrington's burial late yesterday. Only a small contingent of us attended from HMS Erebus, but along with Sir John, Commander Fitzjames and a few officers, I made the crossing on foot from our ship to theirs, and hence the extra 200 yards to the shore of Beachy Island. I have not been able to imagine a worse winter than the one we have suffered, frozen into this small anchorage in the lee of Beachy Island itself, set in the cusp of larger Devon Island. But Commander Fitzjames and others have assured me that our situation here, even with the treacherous pressure ridges, terrible dark, howling storms, and constantly menacing ice, would be 1,000 times worse out beyond this anchorage, out where the ice flows down from the pole like a hail of enemy fire from some Borean god. John Torrington's crewmates gently lowered his coffin, already covered with a fine blue wool, over the railing of their ship, which is wedged high on its own pillar of ice, while other Terra seamen lashed the coffin to a large sledge. Sir John himself draped a Union Jack over the coffin, and then Torrington's friends and messmates set themselves into harness and pulled the sledge the 600 feet or so to the ice and gravel shore of Beachy Island. All of this was performed in near absolute dark, of course, since even at midday the sun makes no appearance here in January, and has not done so for 3 months. It shall be another month and more, they tell me, before the southern horizon welcomes back our fiery star. At any rate, this entire procession, coffin, sledge, man-haulers, officers, surgeons, Sir John, Royal Marines in full dress, concealed under the same drab slops the rest of us were wearing, was illuminated only by bobbing lamplight as we made our way across the frozen sea to the frozen shore. Men from Terra had chopped and shovelled away at the several recently arisen pressure ridges which stood between us and the gravelled beach, so there were few deviations from our sad route. Earlier in the winter, Sir John ordered a system of stout poles, ropes, and hanging lanterns to line the shortest route between the ships and the gravelled isthmus where several structures had been built, one to house much of the ship's stores, removed should ice destroy our vessels, another as a sort of emergency bunkhouse and scientific station, and a third, housing the armourer's forge, set here so that the flames and sparks should not ignite our tindered shipboard homes. I have learned that sailors fear fire at sea above almost everything else, but this course of wooden poles and lanterns had to be abandoned since the ice is constantly shifting, rising up and scattering or smashing anything set out on it. It was snowing during the burial. The wind was blowing hard, as it always does here on this godforsaken Arctic waste. Just north of the burial site rose sheer black cliffs, as inaccessible as the mountains of the moon. The lanterns lit on Erebus and Terra were only the dimmest of glows through the blowing snow. Occasionally a fragment of cold moon would appear from between quickly moving clouds, but even this thin, pale moonlight was quickly lost in the snow and dark. Dear God, this is truly a Stygian bleakness. Some of the strongest men from Terra worked almost without pause since the hours right after Torrington's death, using pickaxe and spade to excavate his grave, a regulation 5 feet deep, as commanded by Sir John. The hole had been dug out of the most severely frozen ice and rock, and one glance at it revealed to me what labour had gone into its excavation. The flag was removed, and the coffin was lowered carefully, almost reverently, into the narrow pit. Snow immediately covered the top of the coffin, and glistened in the light from our several lanterns. One man, one of Crozier's officers, set the wooden headboard in place, and it was driven down into the frozen gravel with a few slams of a giant wooden hammer, wielded by a giant of a seaman. The words on that carefully carved headboard read, "Sacred to the memory of John Torrington, who departed this life January 1st, A.D. 1846, on board of H.M. Ship Terror, aged 20 years. Sir John conducted the service and spoke the eulogy. It went on for some time, and the soft drone of his soft voice was interrupted only by the wind and by the stamping of feet as the men tried to avoid frostbite of the toes. I confess that I heard little of Sir John's eulogy between the howling wind and my own wandering thoughts, oppressed by the loneliness of the place, by the memory of the striped shirted body, limbs bound, that had just been lowered into that cold hole, and oppressed most of all by the eternal blackness of the cliffs above the gravelled isthmus. 4 January, 1846. Another man is dead. One of our own here on HMS Erebus, 25-year-old John Hartnell, an able seaman. Just after what I still think of as 6 p.m, just as the tables were being lowered on chains for the men's dinner, Hartnell stumbled against his brother Thomas, fell to the deck, coughed blood, and was dead within 5 minutes. Surgeon Stanley and I were with him when he died in the cleared part of the forward area of the lower deck, which we use for sick bay. This death stunned us. Hartnell had shown no symptoms of scurvy or consumption. Commander Fitzjames was there with us and could not hide his consternation. If this were some plague or beginning of scurvy moving through the crew, we needed to know at once. It was decided then and there, while the curtains were drawn, and before anyone made ready to prepare John Hartnell for his coffin, that we would do a post-mortem examination. We cleared the table in the sick bay area, shielded our actions further by moving some crates between the milling men and ourselves, drew the curtain around our labours as best we could, and I fetched my instruments. Stanley, although chief surgeon, suggested that I should do the work since I had studied as an anatomist. I made the initial incision and began. Immediately I realized that in my haste I had used the inverted Y incision that I had used in training on cadavers when I was in a rush, rather than the more common Y with the two arms of the incision reaching down from the shoulders and meeting at the base of the sternum. My upside-down Y incision had the arms of the Y starting near each hip and meeting near Hartnell's umbilicus. Stanley commented upon it and I was embarrassed. "Whatever is faster," I said softly to my fellow surgeon. "We must do this quickly. The men hate knowing that bodies of their crewmates are being opened." Surgeon Stanley nodded, and I continued. As if to confirm my statement, Hartnell's younger brother Thomas began shouting and crying from just the other side of the curtain. Unlike Torrington's slow decline on terror, giving his crewmates time to come to terms with his death, time to parcel out his belongings and prepare letters for Torrington's mother, John Hartnell's sudden collapse and death had shocked the men here. None of them could abide the idea that the ship's surgeons were cutting into the body. Now only the bulk, rank, and demeanor of Commander Fitzjames stood between the angry brother, confused seaman, and our sick bay. I could hear that the younger Hartnell's messmates and Fitzjames' presence were holding him back. But even as my scalpel cut through tissue and my knife and rib spreader opened the corpse for examination, I could hear the muttering and anger just a few yards beyond the curtain. First, I removed Hartnell's heart, cutting away part of the trachea with it. I held it up to the lantern light and Stanley took it and washed away blood with a dirty rag. We both inspected it. It looked normal enough, not visibly diseased. With Stanley still holding the organ close to the light, I made one cut in the right ventricle, then one in the left, peeling the tough muscle back. Both Stanley and I reviewed the valves there. They seemed healthy. Dropping Hartnell's heart back into his abdominal cavity, I dissected the lower part of the able seaman's lungs with quick strokes of my scalpel.
"There,"
said Surgeon Stanley. I nodded. There were obvious signs of scarring and other indications of consumption, as well as signs that the seaman recently had been suffering from pneumonia. John Hartnell, like John Torrington, had been tubercular, but this older, stronger, and, according to Stanley, harsher and louder sailor had concealed the symptoms, perhaps even from himself, until today, when he keeled over and died just minutes before getting his salt pork. Pulling and cutting the liver free, I held it under the light, and both Stanley and I believed that we noticed adequate confirmation of the consumption, as well as indications that Hartnell had been too heavy a drinker for too long a time. Just yards away on the other side of the curtain, Hartnell's brother Thomas was shouting, furious, being held in check only by Commander Fitzjames's stern bark. I could tell from the voices that several of the other officers, Lieutenant Gore, Lieutenant Le Vicomte, and Fairholme, even Devoe, the mate, had joined in calming and intimidating the mob of sailors.
"Have we seen enough?" whispered Stanley.
I nodded again. There had been no sign of scurvy on the body, on the face or in the mouth or in the organs. While it remained a mystery how the consumption or pneumonia, or a combination of the two, had been able to kill the able-bodied seaman so quickly, it was at least obvious that we had nothing to fear from some plague-like disease. The noise from the crew's berthing space was growing louder, so I quickly thrust the lung samples, liver, and other organs back in the abdominal cavity with the heart, taking no care to set them in proper place, more or less squeezing them into a mass, and then I returned Hartnell's chest plate roughly back in place. Later, I was to realize that I'd set it in upside down. Chief Surgeon Stanley then closed up the inverted Y incision using a large needle and heavy sail thread with a quick, confident motion that would have done credit to any sailmaker. Within another minute, we had Hartnell's clothes back on. Rigor mortis was beginning to be a problem, and we thrust the curtain aside. Stanley, whose voice is deeper and more resonant than mine, assured Hartnell's brother and the other men that all we had remaining was to wash their crewmate's body so that they could prepare it for burial. 6 January, 1846. For some reason, this burial service was harder on me than the first. Again, we had the solemn procession from the ship, with only Erebus and its crew involved this time, although Dr. MacDonald, Surgeon Petty, and Captain Crozier joined us from Terra. Again, the flag-covered coffin. The men had dressed Hartnell's upper body in three layers, including his brother Thomas's best shirt, but had wrapped his naked lower body in only a shroud, leaving the top half of the coffin open for several hours in the black craped sick bay on the lower deck before the nails were hammered in for the burial service.
Again, the slow sledge procession from the frozen sea to the frozen shore, lanterns bobbing in the black night, although the stars were out this midday and no snow fell. The Marines had work to do, since three of the great white bears came sniffing closer, looming like white wraiths out of the ice blocks, and the men had to fire muskets at them to drive them away, visibly wounding one bear in the side. Again, the eulogy from Sir John, although shorter this time, since Hartnell was not as well liked as young Torrington had been. And again, we walked back across the creaking, squeaking, moaning ice alone, under the stars dancing in the cold this time, the only sound behind us, the dwindling scrape of spades and pickaxes filling in the frozen soil in the new hole next to Torrington's nicely tended grave. Perhaps it was the black cliff face looming over all that murdered my spirits this second burial. Although I deliberately stood where my back was to the cliff this time, closer to Sir John so that I could hear the words of hope and solace, I was always aware of that cold, black, vertical, lifeless and lightless slab of insensate stone behind me. A portal, it seemed, to that country from which no man has ever returned. Compared to the cold reality of that black, featureless stone, even Sir John's compassionate and inspired words had little effect. The morale on both ships is very low. We are not yet a full week into the new year, and already two of our company have died. Tomorrow, the four of us surgeons have agreed to meet in a private place, the carpenter's room below decks on Terra, to discuss what should be done to avoid more mortality in what seems to be a cursed expedition. The headstone on this second grave read, "Sacred to the memory of John Hartnell, A.B. of HMS Erebus. Died January 4th, 1846, aged 25 years. Thus saith the Lord of Hosts, consider your ways." Haggai 1:7. The wind has come up in the last hour. It is almost midnight, and most of the lamps are out here on the lower deck of Erebus. I listen to the wind howl, and think of those two cold, low heaps of loose stone out on that black, windy isthmus. And I think of the dead men in those two cold holes, and I think of the featureless black face of rock. And I can imagine the fusillade of snow pellets already working to eradicate the letters on the wooden headstones. Chapter 7. Franklin. Latitude, 70 degrees, 3 minutes, 29 seconds north. Longitude, 98 degrees, 20 minutes west. Approximately 28 miles north-northwest of King William Land, 3 September, 1846. Captain Sir John Franklin had rarely been so pleased with himself. The previous winter, frozen in at Beachy Island, hundreds of miles northeast of his present position, had been uncomfortable in many ways. He would be the first to admit that to himself, or to a peer, although he had no peers on this expedition. The death of three members of the expedition, first Torrington and Hartnell, so early in January, then Private William Brain of the Royal Marines on 3 April, all of consumption and pneumonia, had been a shock. Franklin was not aware of any other Navy expedition losing three men of natural causes so early in their endeavour. It was Franklin himself who had chosen the inscription on the 32-year-old Private Bain's headstone. "Choose this day whom ye shall serve." Joshua, chapter 24, verse 15. And for a short while, the words had seemed as much a challenge to the unhappy crews of Erebus and Terra, not yet near mutiny, but neither so far away from it, as it was a message to the non-existent passerby of Brain's, Hartnell's, and Torrington's lonely graves on that terrible spit of gravel and ice. Nonetheless, the four surgeons met and conferred after Hartnell's death and decided that incipient scurvy might be weakening the men's constitutions, allowing pneumonia and such congenital defects as consumption to rise to lethal proportions. Surgeons Stanley, Goodsir, Peddy, and MacDonald recommended to Sir John that the men's diet be changed. Fresh food, when possible, although there was almost none except polar bear possible in the dark of winter, and they had discovered that eating the liver of that great ponderous beast could be fatal for some unknown reason. And, failing finding fresh meat and vegetables, cutting back on the men's preferred salted pork and beef, or salted birds, and relying more on the tinned foods, vegetable soups and the like. Sir John had gone along with the recommendation, Ordering the diet on both ships changed so that no less than half the meals were prepared with tinned foods from stores. It seemed to have turned the trick. No more men died or were even seriously sick between Private Brain's death in early April and the day both ships were freed from their icy imprisonment within the harbour of Beachy Island in late May of 1846. After that, the ice broke up quickly, and Franklin, following the paths through the leads chosen by his two fine ice masters, steamed and sailed south and west, going, as the captains of Sir John's generation liked to say, like smoke and oakum. Along with the sunlight and open water, animals, birds, and aquatic life returned in plenitude. During those long, slow Arctic summer days, where the sun remained above the horizon until almost midnight, and the temperature sometimes rose above freezing, the skies were filled with migrating birds. Franklin himself could identify the petrels from the teals, eider ducks from the little auks, and the sprightly little puffins from all others. The ever-widening leads around Erebus and Terror were alive with right whales that would have been the envy of any Yankee whaler, and there was a profusion of cod, herring, and other small fish, as well as the large beluga and bowhead whales. The men put out the whaling boats and fished, often shooting some of the small whales just for sport. Every hunting party came back with fresh game for the tables each night. Birds, of course, but also those confounded ringed and harp seals, so impossible to shoot or catch in their holes in the winter, now brazen on the open ice and easy targets. The men did not enjoy the taste of the seals, too oily and astringent, but something about the blubber in the slimy beasts appealed to all their winter-starved appetites. They also shot the large, bellowing walruses, visible through telescopes tusking away for oysters along the shores, and some hunting parties returned with the pelts and flesh of the white Arctic fox. The men ignored the lumbering polar bears unless the waddling beasts seemed ready to attack or contest the kill of the human hunters. No one really liked the taste of the white bears, and certainly not when there was so much tastier game to be found. Franklin's orders included an option. If he found his way toward the southern approach to the Northwest Passage blocked by ice or other obstacles, to turn north and to follow the Wellington Passage into the open polar sea. In essence, to sail to the North Pole. But Franklin did what he had done without question his entire life. He followed his primary orders. This second summer in the Arctic, his two ships had sailed south from Devon Island, Franklin leading HMS Erebus and HMS Terror past Cape Walker into the unknown waters of an icy archipelago. The previous summer, it had seemed as if he would have to settle for sailing to the North Pole rather than finding the Northwest Passage. Captain Sir John Franklin had reason to be proud of his speed and efficiency so far. During his shortened summer voyage time that year before, 1845, they had departed England late and Greenland even later than planned. He had nonetheless crossed Baffin Bay in record time, passed through Lancaster Sound south of Devon Island, then through Barrow Strait and found his way south, past Walker Point, blocked by ice so late in August. But his ice masters reported open water to the north, past the western reaches of Devon Island into the Wellington Channel, so Franklin obeyed his secondary orders and turned north toward what could be an ice-free passage into the open polar sea and the North Pole. There had been no opening to the fabled open polar sea. The Grinnell Peninsula, which might have been part of an unknown Arctic continent for all the men of the Franklin expedition knew, had blocked their way and forced them to follow open water north by west, then almost due west, until they reached the western tip of that peninsula, turned north again, and encountered a solid mass of ice that extended north from the Wellington Channel, apparently, to infinity. 5 days of sailing along that high wall of ice convinced Franklin, Fitzjames, Crozier, and the ice masters that there was no open polar sea north of the Wellington Channel, at least not that summer. Worsening ice conditions made them turn south, around the landmass previously known as only Cornwallis Land, but now understood to be Cornwallis Island. If nothing else, Captain Sir John Franklin knew his expedition had solved that puzzle. With pack ice quickly freezing in place that late summer of 1845, Franklin had finished circumnavigating the huge, barren Cornwallis Island, re-entered the Barrow Strait north of Cape Walker, confirmed that the way south past Cape Walker was still blocked, now solid with ice, and sought out their winter anchorage at Little Beachy Island, entering a little harbour they had reconnoitred 2 weeks earlier. They arrived just in time, Franklin knew, for the day after they anchored in the shallow water of that harbour, the last open leads in Lancaster Sound beyond closed up, and the moving pack ice would have made any more sailing impossible. It was doubtful if even such masterpieces of reinforced iron and oak technology as Erebus and Terror would have survived the winter out in the channel ice. But now it was summer, and they had been sailing south and west for weeks, restoring their provisions when they could, following every lead, seeking out any glint of open water they could spy from the lookout's position high on the mainmast, and every day smashing and forcing their way through the ice when they had to. HMS Erebus continued to lead the way in the icebreaking, as was her right as the flagship and her logical responsibility as the heavier ship with a more powerful, 5 horsepower more powerful, steam engine. But, confound it, the long shaft to the screw had been bent by underwater ice. It would neither retract nor work properly, and Terror had moved into the lead position. And with the icy shores of King William Land visible no more than 50 miles ahead of them to the south, the ships had moved out from under the protection of the huge island to their north, the one which had blocked their way directly to the southwest past Cape Walker, where his orders had directed him to sail, and instead had forced him south through Peel Sound and previously unexplored straits. Now the ice to the south and west had become active and almost continuous once again. Their pace had slowed to a crawl. The ice was thicker, the icebergs more frequent, the leads thinner and farther apart. This morning of 3 September, Sir John had called a conference of his captains, top officers, engineers and ice masters. The crowd fit comfortably into Sir John's personal cabin, where this space on HMS Terra served as a great cabin for the officers, complete with libraries and music. The width of the stern of HMS Erebus was Sir John Franklin's private quarters, 12 feet wide by an amazing 20 feet long, with a private commode seat of ease in a room to itself on the starboard side. Franklin's private privy was almost exactly the size of Captain Crozier's and all the other officers' entire cabins. Edmund Hoare, Sir John's steward, had lengthened the dining table until it could accommodate all the officers present. Commander Fitzjames, Lieutenants Gore, Le Vicomte and Fairholme from Erebus, Captain Crozier, and Lieutenants Little, Hodgson and Irving from Terror. Besides those 8 officers seated on either side of the table, Sir John sat at its head, near the starboard bulkhead and entrance to his private head. Also present, standing at the foot of the table, were the 2 ice masters, Mr. Blankey from Terror and Mr. Reed from Erebus, as well as the 2 engineers, Mr. Thompson from Crozier's ship and Mr. Gregory from the flagship. Sir John had also asked one of the surgeons, Stanley from Erebus, to be in attendance. Franklin's steward had set out grape juice, cheeses and ship's biscuits, and there was a short period of chatting and relaxing before Sir John called the conference to order.
"Gentlemen," said Sir John, "I am sure you all know why we are gathered here. Our expedition's advance the last 2 months, thanks to the graciousness of God, has been wonderfully successful. We have left Beachy Island almost 350 miles behind us. Lookouts and our sledge scouts still report glimpses of open water far to our south and west. It still may be in our power, God willing, to reach this open water and to navigate the Northwest Passage this very autumn. But the ice to our west is increasing, I understand, in both thickness and frequency. Mr. Gregory reports that Erebus's main shaft has been damaged by ice, and that although we can make headway under steam, the flagship's effectiveness has been compromised. Our coal supplies are dwindling. Another winter will soon be upon us. In other words, gentlemen, we must decide today what our course of action and direction shall be. I think it is not unfair to say that the success or failure of our expedition shall be determined by what we decide here."
There was a long silence. Sir John gestured to the red-bearded ice master of HMS Erebus.
"Perhaps it would be helpful, before we venture opinions and open discussion, to hear from our ice masters, engineers and surgeon. Mr. Reed, Could you inform the others of what you told me yesterday about our current and projected ice conditions?
Reed, standing on the Erebus side of the five men at the end of the table, cleared his throat. Reed was a solitary sort, and speaking in such exalted company made his face flush redder than his beard.
Sir John, gentlemen, it ain't no secret that we've been darned lucky in terms of ice conditions since the ships was released from ice in May, and since we left Beachy Island Harbour around the 1st of June, while we was in the Straits, we've been ploughing through mostly sludge ice. That ain't no problem. Nights, them few hours of darkness we have what's called nights up here, we cut through pancake ice. That's like what we've been seeing the last week as the sea's always on the verge of freezing. But that ain't no real problem either. We've been able to stay away from the young ice along the shores. That's more serious stuff. Behind that's the fast ice. That'll tear the hull off even a ship as reinforced as this here and Terror in the lead. But as I say, we stayed away from fast ice so far.
Reed was sweating, obviously wishing he hadn't gone on so long, but also knowing that he hadn't fully addressed Sir John's question yet. He cleared his throat and continued.
So, with the moving ice, Sir John, and your honours, we ain't had much problem with the brash ice and thicker drift ice, and the bergy bits, them little bergs what broke off from the real bergs. We've been able to avoid them, because of the wide leads and open water we've been able to find. But all that's coming to an end, sirs. What with the nights getting longer, the pancake ice is always there now, and we're running into more and more of them growlers and hummocky flows. And it's the hummocky flows that's got Mr. Blanky and me worried.
Why is that, Mr. Reed? Asked Sir John.
His expression showed his habitual boredom at discussions of the different ice conditions. To Sir John, ice was ice, something to be broken through, gone around, and overcome.
It's the snow, Sir John, said Reed. The deep snow atop 'em, sir, and the tide marks on the side. Such always signifies old pack ice ahead, sir, real screwed pack. And that's where we get frozen in, you see.
And as far as we can see, or sledge ahead to the south and west, sirs, it's all pack ice, except for the possible glint of open water way down south of King William Land.
The Northwest Passage, Commander Fitzjames said softly.
Perhaps, said Sir John.
Most probably. But to get there, we shall have to cross through more than 100 miles of pack ice. Perhaps as much as 200 miles of it. I am told that the Ice Master of Terror has a theory about why the conditions worsen to our west. Mr. Blanky?
Thomas Blanky did not blush. The older Ice Master's voice was a staccato explosion of syllables, as blunt as musket fire.
It's deaf to enter that pack ice. We've come too far already. The fact is, since we came out of Peel Sound, we've been looking at an ice stream as bad as anything north at Baffin Bay, and it's getting worse every day.
Why is that, Mr. Blanky? Asked Commander Fitzjames. His confident voice showed a slight lisp.
This late in the season, I understand that we should still have open leads until the sea actually freezes. And close to the mainland, say southwest of the peninsula, of King William Land, we should have some open water for another month or more.
Ice Master Blanky shook his head.
No, this isn't no pancake ice or sludge ice, gentlemen. It's pack ice we're looking at. It's coming down from the northwest. Think of it as a series of giant glaciers, carving bergs and freezing the sea for hundreds of miles as it flows south. We've been protected from it, is all.
Protected by what? Asked Lieutenant Gore, a strikingly handsome and personable officer. It was Captain Crozier who answered, nodding at Blanky to step back.
By all the islands to our west, as we've come south, Graham, said the Irishman. Just as we discovered a year ago that Cornwallis Land was an island, we know now that Prince of Wales Land is really Prince of Wales Island. The bulk of it has been blocking the full force of the ice stream until we came out of Peel Sound. Now we can see that it's full pack ice being forced south, between whatever islands are up there to our northwest, possibly all the way to the mainland. Whatever open water is down there along the coast to the south won't last long, nor will we if we forge ahead and try to winter out here in the open pack ice.
That is one opinion, said Sir John. And we thank you for it, Francis. But we must decide now on our course of action. Yes, James?
Commander Fitzjames looked, as he almost always did, relaxed and in charge. He had actually put on weight during the expedition, so his buttons appeared ready to pop from his uniform. His cheeks were rosy, and his blonde hair hung in longer curls than he'd worn in England. He smiled at everyone along the table.
Sir John, I agree with Captain Crozier that to be caught out in the pack ice we're facing would be unfortunate, but I do not believe that will be our fate should we forge on. I believe that it is imperative that we get as far south as we can, either to reach the open water to realize our goal of finding the Northwest Passage, which I think we shall do before winter sets in, or simply to find safer waters near the coast, perhaps a harbor where we can winter in relative comfort as we did at Beachy Island. At the very least, we know from Sir John's earlier expeditions overland and from previous naval expeditions that the water tends to stay open much later near the coast because of the warmer waters coming in from the rivers.
And if we don't reach open water, or the coast, by going southwest?
Crozier asked softly. Fitzjames made a deprecating gesture.
At least we will be closer to our goal come the thaw next spring. What's our alternative, Francis? You aren't seriously suggesting returning up the strait to Beachy or trying to retreat to Baffin Bay?
Crozier shook his head.
Right now, we can as easily sail to the east of King William Land as to the west.
More easily, since we know from our lookouts and scouts that there's still ample open water to the east.
Sail to the east of King William Land, said Sir John,
his voice incredulous.
Francis, that would be a dead end. We would be sheltered by the peninsula, yes, but frozen in hundreds of miles east of here, in a long bay that might not thaw next spring.
Unless, said Crozier, looking around the table, unless King William Land is also an island. In which case, we would have the same protection from the pack ice flowing from the northwest that Prince of Wales Island has been giving us the past month of travel. It would be probable that the open water on the east side of King William Land will extend almost to the coast, where we can sail west along the warmer waters there for more weeks. Perhaps find a perfect harbor. Perhaps at a river's mouth, if we have to spend a second winter in the ice.
There was a long silence in the room. Erebus Lieutenant H.T.D. Le Vicomte cleared his throat.
You believe in the theories of that eccentric Dr. King, he said softly.
Crozier frowned. He knew that the theories of Dr. Richard King, not even a Navy man, a mere civilian, were disliked and discarded, primarily because King believed, and had very vocally expressed, that such large naval expeditions as Sir John's were foolish, dangerous, and absurdly expensive. King believed, based upon his mapping and experience with Back's overland expedition years before, that King William Land was an island, while Boothia, the ostensible island even farther to their east, was actually a long peninsula. King argued that the easiest and safest way to find the Northwest Passage was to send small parties overland in northern Canada and to follow the warmer coastal waters west that the hundreds of thousands of square miles of sea to the north were a dangerous maze of islands and ice streams that could swallow up 1,000 Erebuses and Terrors. Crozier knew that there was a copy of King's controversial book in Erebus's library. He had checked it out and read it, and it was still in Crozier's cabin on Terra. But he also knew that he was the only man on the expedition who had, or would, read the book.
No, said Crozier. I'm not subscribing to King's theories. I'm merely suggesting a strong possibility. Look, we thought that Cornwallis Land was huge, perhaps part of the Arctic continent, but we sailed around it in a few days. Many of us thought that Devon Island continued north and west directly into the open polar sea, but our two ships found the western end of it, and we saw the open channels north.
Our orders instructed us to sail directly southwest from Cape Walker, but we found that Prince of Wales Land was directly in the way, and what is more pertinent, that it is, almost without doubt, an island, and the low strip of ice we glimpsed to our east while heading south may well have been a frozen strait separating Somerset Island from Boothia Felix, and showing that King was wrong. That Boothia is not a continuous peninsula all the way north to Lancaster Sound.
There is no evidence that the low area of ice we saw was a strait, said Lieutenant Gore. It makes more sense to consider it a low ice-covered isthmus, such as we saw on Beachy Island.
Prosius shrugged.
Perhaps, but our experience on this expedition has been that landmasses previously thought to be very large or connected have in truth been shown to be islands. I suggest that we reverse course, avoid the pack ice to the southwest, and sail east and then south down the eastern coast of what may well be King William Island. At the very least, we will be sheltered from this seaborne glacier that Mr. Blanky talks about. And should we discover the worst, that it is a long, narrow bay, odds are very great that we could sail north again around the point of King William Land next summer and be right back here, and none the worse for wear.
Except for the coal burned and the precious time lost, said Commander Fitzjames.
Crozier nodded.
Sir John rubbed his round and well-shaved cheeks. In the silence, Terra's engineer, James Thompson, spoke.
Sir John, gentlemen, since the issue of the ship's coal reserves has been brought up, I would like to mention that we are very, very close to reaching, and I mean this quite literally, a point of no return in terms of our fuel. Just in the past week, using our steam engines to force a way through the fringes of this pack ice, we've gone through more than a quarter of our remaining coal reserves. We are now just above 50% of our coal remaining. Less than 2 weeks of normal steaming, but only days worth, trying to force the ice as we have. Should we be frozen in for another winter, we will be burning much of that reserve, just to heat the ships again.
We could always send a party ashore to cut trees for firewood, said Lieutenant Edward Little, sitting at Crozier's left.
For a minute, every man in the room except Sir John laughed heartily. It was a welcome break in the tension. Perhaps Sir John was remembering his first overland expeditions north to the coastal regions now to their south. The mainland tundra extended for 900 barren miles south from the coast before one would see the first tree or serious shrub.
There is one way to maximize our steaming distances, Crozier said softly into the more relaxed silence following the laughter.
Everyone's head turned toward the captain of HMS Terra.
We transfer all the crew and coal from Erebus to Terror and make a run for it, continued Crozier, either through the ice to the southwest or to reconnoiter down the east coast of King William Land or Island.
Go for broke,
said Ice Master Blanky into the now stunned silence.
Aye, that makes sense.
Sir John could only blink. When he finally found his voice, it still sounded incredulous, as if Crozier had made a second joke that he could not understand.
Abandon the flagship, he said at last. Abandon Erebus?
He glanced around as if just having the other officers look at his cabin would settle this issue once and for all. The bulkheads, lined with shelves and books, the crystal and china on the table, the three Preston patent illuminators set into the width of the overhead, allowing rich late summer light to stream into the cabin.
Abandon Erebus, Francis, he said again, his voice stronger, but spoken in a tone of someone who wants to be let in on a rather obscure joke.
Crozier nodded.
The main shaft is bent, sir. Your own engineer, Mr. Gregory, has told us that it cannot be repaired nor retracted any longer, outside of a dry dock. Certainly not while we are in pack ice. It will only get worse. With two ships, we have only a few days or a week's worth of coal for the battle necessary to fight the pack ice. We'll all be frozen in, both ships, if we fail. If we freeze into the open sea to the west of King William Land, we have no idea where the current will move the ice, of which we will be a part. The odds are great that we could be thrown into the shallows along the lee shore there. That means the destruction of even such wonderful ships as these.
Crozier nodded around him and at the skylights above.
But if we consolidate our fuel in the less damaged ship, continued Crozier, and especially if we have some luck finding open water down the east side of King William Land, we will have much more than a month's fuel for steaming west along the coast as fast as we can. Erebus would have been sacrificed, but we might, we will, reach Point Turnagain and familiar points along the coast within a week. Complete the Northwest Passage into the open Pacific this year instead of next.
Abandon Erebus, repeated Sir John.
He did not sound cross or angry.
only perplexed by the absurdity of the notion being discussed.
"Conditions would be very cramped aboard Terra," said Commander Fitzjames.
He seemed to be seriously considering the notion. Captain Sir John turned to his right and stared at his favourite officer. Sir John's face was slowly assuming the cold smile of a man who has not only been left out of a joke on purpose, but may well be the butt of it.
"Crowded, but not intolerably so, for a month or two," said Crozier.
"My Mr. Honey and your ship's carpenter, Mr. Weeks, will supervise the breaking down of interior bulkheads. All officers' quarters to be dismantled, except for the great room, which could be turned into Sir John's quarters aboard Terror, and perhaps the officers' mess. That would give us ample room, even for another year or more on the ice. These old bomb ships have a great amount of space below decks, if nothing else."
"It would take some time to transfer the coal and ship stores," said Lieutenant Le Vicomte.
Crozier nodded again.
"I've had my purser, Mr. Helpman, work out some preliminary figures.
You may remember that Mr. Goldner, the expedition's provisioner of canned foods, failed to deliver the bulk of his goods until less than 48 hours before we sailed. So we had to repack both ships to a great extent. We did so in time to meet our departure date. Mr. Helpman estimates that with both crews working through the long daylight, sleeping on half-watch schedules, that everything we can hold on one ship can be transferred to Terror in just under 3 days. We'd be a crowded family for some weeks, but it would be as if we're starting anew on the expedition. Coal reserves topped off, food for another year, a ship in full working condition."
"Go for broke," repeated Ice Master Blanky.
Sir John shook his head and chuckled, as if he had finally had enough of this particular joke.
"Well, Francis, that is a very interesting speculation. But of course we shall not be abandoning Erebus, nor Terra either, should your ship suffer some minor misfortune. Now, the one thing I've not heard at this table today is a suggestion to retreat to Baffin Bay. Am I correct in the assumption that no one is suggesting that?"
The room was silent. Overhead came the rumble and scrape of crewmen holystoning the decks for the second time that day.
"Very well, then. It is decided," said Sir John. "We shall press forward. Not only do our orders direct us to do this, but as several of you gentlemen have pointed out, our safety increases the closer we get to the coast of the mainland, even if the land itself there is every bit as inhospitable as the dreadful islands we have passed up here. Francis, James, you may go tell your crews of our decision."
Sir John stood. For a dazed second, the other captains, officers, ice masters, engineers, and surgeon could only stare, but then the naval officers stood quickly, nodded, and began filing out of Sir John's huge cabin. The Surgeon Stanley was plucking at Commander Fitzjames's sleeve as the men went forward along the narrow companionway and stomped up the ladder to the deck.
"Commander, Commander," Stanley said. "Sir John never called on me to report, but I wanted to tell everyone about the increasing numbers of putrid foodstuff we've been finding in the tinned goods."
Fitzjames smiled, but freed his arm.
"We'll arrange a time for you to tell Captain Sir John in private, Mr. Stanley."
"But I've told him in private," persisted the little surgeon. "It's the other officers I wanted to inform, in case—"
"Later, Mr. Stanley," said Commander Fitzjames.
The surgeon was saying something else, but Crozier passed beyond earshot and waved to John Lane, his bosun, to bring his gig alongside for the sunny ride back up the narrow lead to where Terra's bow was wedged in the thickening pack ice. Black smoke still poured from the leading ship's funnel. Heading southwest into the pack ice, the two ships made slow headway for another 4 days. HMS Terra burned coal at a prodigious rate, using its steam engine to throw itself against the ever-thicker pack ice. The glint of possible open water far to the south had disappeared, even on sunny days. The temperature dropped suddenly on 9 September. The ice on the long thin line of open water behind the trailing Erebus covered over with pancake ice and then froze solid. The sea around them was already a lifting, surging, static white mass of growlers, real icebergs, and sudden pressure ridges. For 6 days, Franklin tried every trick in his Arctic inventory, spreading black coal powder on the ice ahead of them to melt it more quickly, backing sail,
sending out fatigue parties day and night with their giant ice saws to remove the ice in front of them block by block, shifting ballast, having 100 men at a time hack away with chisels, shovels, picks and poles, setting kedge anchors far ahead of them in the thickening ice, and winching Erebus, which had resumed the lead ahead of Terra on the last day before the ice had suddenly thickened, a yard at a time. Finally, Franklin ordered every able man onto the ice, rigged lines for everyone and sledge harnesses for the largest men among them, and tried hauling the ships forward, a sweating, cursing, shouting, spirit-killing, gut-wrenching, back-breaking inch at a time. Always, promised Sir John, was the reality of open coastal water just another 20 or 30 or 50 miles ahead of them. The open water might as well have been on the surface of the moon. During the lengthening night of 15 September 1846, the temperature plummeted to below zero, and the ice began moaning and scraping against both ships' hulls. In the morning, everyone who came on deck could see for themselves that in each direction the sea had become a white solid, stretching to the horizon. Between sudden snow squalls, both Crozier and Fitzjames were able to get adequate sun sightings to fix their positions. Each captain figured that they were beset at roughly 70 degrees 5 minutes north latitude, 98 degrees 23 minutes west longitude, some 25 miles off the northwest shore of King William Island, or King William Land, whichever the case might be. It was a moot point now. They were in open sea ice, moving pack ice, and stranded directly in front of the full onslaught of Ice Master Blanky's moving glacier, bearing down on them from polar regions to the northwest, from all the way to the unimaginable North Pole. There was not a sheltering harbour to their knowledge within 100 miles, and no way to get there if there were one. At 2 o'clock that afternoon, Captain Sir John Franklin ordered the boiler fires to be drawn on both Erebus and Terra. Steam was let down in both boilers. Just enough pressure would be kept up to move warmed water through the pipes, heating the lower decks of each ship. Sir John made no announcement to the men. None was required. That night, as the men settled into their hammocks on Erebus, and as Hartnell whispered his usual prayer for his dead brother, 35-year-old seaman Abraham Seeley, in the hammock next to him, hissed,
"We're in a world of shit now, Tommy, and not your prayers, nor neither Sir John's, is going to get us out of it. Not for another 10 months at least."
Chapter 8. Crozier. Latitude 70 degrees 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees 23 minutes west. 11 November 1847. It has been 1 year, 2 months and 8 days since Sir John's eventful conference aboard Erebus, and both ships are frozen in the ice, roughly where they were that September day in 1846. Although the current from the northwest moves the entire mass of ice, over the past year it has rotated ice, icebergs, pressure ridges, and both trapped Royal Navy ships in slow circles, so that their position has remained about the same, stranded, some 25 miles north-northwest of King William Land, and slowly revolving, like a blotch of rust, on one of the metal music discs in the officer's great room. Captain Crozier has spent this November day, or rather those hours of darkness which once included daylight as a component, searching for his missing crewmen William Strong and Thomas Evans. There is no hope for either man, of course, and there is great risk that others will be taken by the thing on the ice. But they search, nonetheless. Neither captain nor crew would have it any other way. Four teams of 5 men each, one man to carry 2 lanterns, and 4 ready with shotguns or muskets, search in 4-hour shifts. As one team comes in frozen and shaking, a replacement team waits on deck, in cold weather slops, guns cleaned, loaded, and ready, lanterns filled with oil, and they resume the search in the quadrant the other team has just quit. The 4 teams are moving out from the ship in ever-widening circles through the ice jumbles, their lanterns now visible to the lookouts on deck through the icy mist and darkness, now obscured by growlers, ice boulders, pressure ridges or distance. Captain Crozier and a seaman with a red lamp move from quadrant to quadrant, checking with each team and then returning to Terra to look in on the men and conditions there. This goes on for 12 hours.
At 2 bells in the first dog watch, 6 p.m., the last search parties all come in, none having found the missing men, but several seamen shame-faced at having fired their weapons at wind shrieking among the jagged ice or at the ice itself, thinking some serac a looming white bear. Crozier is the last one in and follows them down to the lower deck. Most of the crewmen have stored their wet slops and boots and gone forward to their mess at tables that have all been cranked down on chains, and the officers gone aft for their meal by the time Crozier comes down the ladder. His steward, Jopson, and First Lieutenant Little hurry over to help him out of his ice-rimmed outer layers.
"You're frozen, Captain," says Jopson. "Your skin is white with frostbite. Come back after the officer's mess for supper, sir."
Crozier shakes his head. "I need to go talk to Commander Fitzjames. Edward, has there been a messenger from his ship while I was out?"
"No, sir," says Lieutenant Little.
"Please eat, Captain,"
persists Jopson. For a steward, he's a large man, and his deep voice becomes more of a growl than a whine when he's imploring his captain. Crozier shakes his head.
"Be so kind as to wrap up a couple of biscuits for me, Thomas. I'll chew on them as I walk to Erebus."
Jopson shows his displeasure at this foolish decision, but hurries forward to where Mr. Diggle is busy at his huge stove. Just now, at dinner time, the lower deck is as toasty warm as it's going to be in any 24-hour period, the temperature rising as high as the mid-40s. Very little coal is being burned for heat these days.
"How many men do you want to go with you, Captain?" asks Little.
"None, Edward. After the men have eaten, I want you to get at least 8 parties on the ice for a final 4 hours of searching."
"But, sir, is it advisable for you to..."
begins Little, but then stops. Crozier knows what he was going to say. The distance between Terra and Erebus is only a little more than a mile, but it is a lonely, dangerous mile, and sometimes takes several hours to cross. If a storm comes up, or the wind simply starts blowing the snow, men can become lost or no longer make progress into the gale. Crozier himself has forbidden men to make the crossing alone, and when messages have to be sent, he dispatches at least 2 men, along with orders to turn back at the first bad weather. Besides the 200-foot-high iceberg, now rising between the two ships, often blocking views even of flares and fires, the pathway, although worked at being kept shoveled open and relatively flat almost every day, is really a maze of constantly shifting seracs, ice-stepped pressure ridges, upturned growlers, and ice-jumble mazes.
"That's all right, Edward," says Crozier. "I'll take my compass."
Lieutenant Little smiles, even though the joke is wearing thin after 3 years in the area. The ships are beset, as far as their instruments can measure, almost directly over the North Magnetic Pole. The compass is about as useful here as a divining rod. Lieutenant Irving sidles up. The young man's cheeks glisten from applied salve where frostbite has left white patches and caused the skin to die and peel back.
"Captain," begins Irving in a rush, "have you seen Silence out on the ice?"
Crozier has taken his cap and muffler off and is rubbing the ice out of his sweat and mist-dampened hair.
"You mean she's not in her little hidey-hole behind the sick bay?"
"No, sir."
"Did you look elsewhere on the lower deck?"
Crozier is mostly worried that with most of the men gone on watch and out in search parties, the Eskimo witch has gotten into something she shouldn't have.
"Aye, sir. No sign of her. I've asked around and no one remembers seeing her since yesterday evening, since before the attack."
"Was she on deck when the thing attacked Private Heather and Seaman Strong?"
"No one knows, Captain. She might have been. Only Heather and Strong were on deck then."
Crozier lets out a breath. It would be ironic, he thinks, if their mystery guest, who first appeared on the day this nightmare began 6 months ago, has finally been carried off by the creature so linked with her appearance.
"Search the whole ship, Lieutenant Irving," he says. "Every nook, cranny, cupboard, and cable locker. We'll use Occam's razor and assume that if she isn't on board, that she's been taken."
"Very well, sir. Shall I choose 3 or 4 men to help me in the search?"
Crozier shakes his head.
"Just you, John. I want everyone else back out on the ice searching for Strong and Evans in the hours before lamps out. And if you don't find Silence, assign yourself to a party and join them."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Reminded of his casualty, Crozier goes forward through the men's mess to the sick bay. Usually at supper time, even in these dark days, there is the morale-lifting sound of conversation and laughter from the men at their mess tables, but tonight there is only silence, broken only by the scrape of spoons on metal and the occasional belch. The men are exhausted, slumped on their sea chests they use as chairs, and only tired, slack faces look up at their captain as he squeezes past. Crozier knocks on the wooden post to the right of the sick bay curtain and passes through. Surgeon Peddy looks up from some sewing he is doing on able seaman George Cann's left forearm at a table in the center of the space.
"Good evening, Captain,"
says the surgeon. Cann knuckles his forehead with his good hand.
"What happened, Cann?"
The young sailor grunts.
"Fucking shotgun barrel slides up me sleeve, touches me fucking bare arm when I was climbing up a fucking ice ridge, Captain. Pardon the language. I pull the shotgun out, and 6 inches of fucking flesh comes with it."
Crozier nods and looks around. The sick bay is small, but 6 cots are crammed into it now. One is empty. 3 men, down with what Peddy and MacDonald tell him is probably scurvy, are sleeping. A 4th man, David Lays, is staring at the ceiling. He has been conscious, but strangely unresponsive for almost a week now. The 5th cot holds Marine Private William Heather. Crozier lifts a 2nd lamp from its hook on the starboard partition and holds the light over Heather. The man's eyes glisten, but he does not blink as Crozier brings the lamp closer. His pupils seem permanently dilated. His skull has been wrapped with a bandage, but blood and grey matter are already seeping through.
"Is he alive?" Crozier asks softly.
Peddy comes over, wiping his bloody hands with a rag.
"He is, strangely enough.
But we could see his brains on deck. I can see them now."
Peddy nods tiredly.
"That happens. In other circumstances, he might even recover. He would be an idiot, of course, but I could screw in a metal covering where his skull is missing and his family, if he has any, could take care of him. Keep him as a sort of pet. But here," Peddy shrugs, "pneumonia or scurvy or starvation will carry him away."
"How soon?" asks Crozier.
Seaman Cann has gone out through the curtain.
"Only God knows," says Peddy. "Is there to be more searching for Evans and Strong, Captain?"
"Yes."
Crozier sets the lantern back in place on the partition near the entrance. Shadows flow back over Marine Private Heather.
"You are aware, I'm sure," says the exhausted surgeon, "that there is no chance for young Evans or Strong, but every probability that each search will bring more wounds, more frostbite, a greater chance of amputation. Many men have already lost one or more toes, and the inevitability that someone will shoot someone else in their panic."
Crozier looks steadily at the surgeon. If one of his officers or men had spoken to Crozier like this, he would have the man flogged. The captain makes allowance for the man's civilian status and exhausted state. Dr. MacDonald has been in his hammock with the influenza for 3 days and nights, and Peddy has been very busy.
"Please, let me worry about the risks of continued searching, Mr. Peddy."
"You worry about stitching up the men stupid enough to set bare metal against their skin when it's 60 below zero. Besides, if that thing out there carried you off into the night, wouldn't you want us to search for you?"
Peddy laughs hollowly.
"If this particular specimen of Ursus maritimus carries me off, Captain, I can only hope that I have my scalpel with me, so I can put it through my own eye."
"Then keep your scalpel close, Mr. Peddy," says Crozier, and goes out through the curtain into the odd silence of the crewman's mess area.
Jopson is waiting in the galley glow with a kerchief of hot biscuits. Crozier enjoys his walk in spite of the creeping cold that has made his face, fingers, legs, and feet feel like they are on fire. He knows that this is preferable to them being numb, and he enjoys the walk in spite of the fact that between the slow moanings and sudden shrieks of the ice moving under and around him in the dark, and the constant moan of the wind, he is certain that he is being stalked. 20 minutes into his 2-hour walk, more a climb, scuttle, and arse-sliding descent, up, over and down pressure ridges for much of the way tonight than a walk, the clouds part and a 3/4 moon appears and illuminates the phantasmagoric landscape. The moon is bright enough to have an ice-crystalled lunar halo around it. Actually, 2 concentric halos, he notices, the diameter of the larger one sufficient to cover 1/3 of the eastern night sky. There are no stars. Crozier dims his lamp to save oil and walks on, using the boat pike he's brought along to test every fold of black ahead of him to make sure it's a shadow and not a crack or crevasse. He has reached the area on the east side of the iceberg now, where the moon is blocked, the berg throwing a black and twisted shadow for a quarter of a mile of ice. Jobson and Little insisted he take a shotgun, but he told them he did not want to carry the weight on the walk. More to the point, he doesn't really believe a shotgun will be of any use against the foe they had in mind. In a particular moment of rare calm, everything strangely quiet except for his labored breathing, Crozier suddenly recalls a resonant instance from when he was a young boy returning home late one winter evening from an afternoon in the wintry hills with his friends. At first, he rushed headlong alone across the frost-rimed heather, but then he paused half a mile or so from his house. He remembers standing there, watching the lighted windows in the village as the last of the winter twilight faded from the sky and the surrounding hills became vague, black, featureless shapes, unfamiliar to a boy so young, until even his own house, visible at the edge of town, lost all definition and three-dimensionality in the dying light. Crozier remembers the snow beginning to fall and himself standing there alone in the darkness, beyond the stone sheep pens, knowing that he would be cuffed for his tardiness, knowing that arriving later would only make the cuffing worse, but having no will nor want to walk toward the light of home yet. He enjoyed the soft sound of night wind and the knowledge that he was the only boy, perhaps the only human being, out there in the dark, on the windy, frozen grass meadows on this night that smelled of coming snow, alienated from the lighted windows and the warm hearths, very aware that he was of the village, but not part of it at that moment. It was a thrilling, almost erotic feeling, an illicit discovery of self, separated from everyone and everything else in the cold and dark, and he feels it again now, as he has more than a few times during his years of Arctic service at opposite poles of the Earth. Something is coming down the high ridge behind him. Crozier turns the oil lantern up and sets it on the ice. The circle of golden light reaches barely 15 feet and makes the darkness beyond all the worse. Using his teeth, he pulls off his heavy mitten, lets it drop to the ice, leaving only a thin glove on that hand, shifts the boat pike to his left hand, and pulls his pistol from his coat pocket. Crozier cocks the weapon as the rustle of sliding ice and snow on the pressure ridge becomes louder. The line of shadow from the iceberg blocks the moonlight here, and the captain can make out only the huge shapes of ice blocks seeming to move and shift in the flickering light. Then, something furry and indistinct moves along the ice ledge he has just descended, some 10 feet above him and less than 15 feet to the west, well within leaping distance.
"Halt," Crozier says, extending the heavy pistol. "Identify yourself."
The shape makes no sound. It moves again. Crozier holds his fire. Dropping the long boat pike, he grabs up the lantern and thrusts it forward. He sees the rippling fur moving and almost fires, but checks himself at the last instant. The shape slides lower, moving quickly and surely down onto the ice. Crozier lowers the hammer on his pistol and sets it back in his pocket, crouching to retrieve his mitten even while keeping the lantern extended. Lady Silence walks into the light, her fur parka and sealskin pants making her look like some short, rounded beast. The hood is pulled forward against the wind, and Crozier cannot see her face.
"God damn it, woman," he says softly. "You came a horny seaman's second from being shot. Where the hell have you been, anyway?"
She steps closer, almost within reaching distance, but her face remains veiled by darkness within the hood. Feeling a sudden chill along the back of his neck and down his spine, Crozier is remembering his grandmother Moira's description of a banshee's transparent skull face within the folds of its black hood. He raises the lantern between them. The young woman's face is human, not banshee, the dark eyes wide as they reflect the light. She has no expression. Crozier realizes that he has never seen an expression on her face, other than perhaps a mildly inquisitive look. Not even on the day they shot and killed her husband, or brother, or father, and she watched the man choke to death on his own blood.
"No wonder the men think you're a witch and a Jonah," says Crozier.
On the ship, in front of the men, he is always polite and formal to this Eskimo wench, but he is not on the ship or in front of the men now. It is the first and only time he and the damned woman have been away from the ship at the same time, and he is very cold and very tired. Lady Silence stares at him. Then she extends a mittened hand. Crozier lowers the lamp toward it, and he sees that she is offering him something, a limp, grey offering, like a fish that has been gutted and boned, leaving only the skin. He realizes that it is a crewman's woolen stocking. Crozier takes it, feels the lump at the toe of the sock, and for a second is sure that the lump will be part of a man's foot, probably the ball of the foot and the toes, still pink and warm. Crozier has been to France, and known men posted to India. He has heard the story of werewolves and were-tigers. In Van Diemen's Land, where he met Sophia Cracroft, she told him of the locals' tales of natives who could turn into a monstrous creature there they called the Tasmanian Devil, a creature capable of tearing a man limb from limb. Shaking the stocking, Crozier looks into Lady Silence's eyes. They are as black as the holes in the ice through which the terrors lowered their dead, until even those holes froze solid. It is a lump of ice, not part of a foot, but the stocking itself is not frozen hard. The wool has not been out here for long in minus 60 degree cold. Logic suggests that this woman has brought it with her from the ship, but for some reason, Crozier does not think so. Strong, says the captain. Evans? Silence shows no reaction to the names. Crozier sighs, stuffs the stocking in his coat pocket, and lifts the boat pike. We're closer to Erebus than Terror, he says. You'll just have to come with me. Crozier turns his back on her, feeling the chill along his neck and spine again in doing so, and crunches off through the rising wind toward the now visible outline of the Terror's sister ship. A minute later, he can hear her soft footsteps on the ice behind him. They clamber over a final pressure ridge, and Crozier can see that Erebus is more brightly lit than he's seen before. A dozen or more lanterns hang from spars just on this visible port side of the icebound, absurdly lifted and steeply canting vessel. It's a prodigious waste of lamp oil. The Erebus, Crozier knows, has suffered more than his Terror. Besides bending the long propeller shaft last summer, the shaft that had been built to be retracted but hadn't done so in time to avoid damage from the underwater ice during their ice breaking in July, and losing the screw itself, the flagship had been mauled more than her sister ship during the past two winters. The ice in the comparative shelter of the Beachy Island harbour had warped, splintered, and loosened hull timbers to a greater degree on Erebus than on Terror. The flagship's rudder was damaged in their past summer's mad dash for the passage. The cold has popped more bolts, rivets, and metal brackets in Sir John's ship. Much more of the iron icebreaker cladding on Erebus has been torn free or buckled. And while Terror has also been raised and squeezed by the ice, the last 2 months of this third winter have seen HMS Erebus lifted on a virtual pedestal of ice, even while the pressure from the sea pack splintered along section of the starboard bow, port stern, and bottom hull amidships. Sir John Franklin's flagship, Crozier knows, and its current captain, James Fitzjames, and his crew also know, will never sail again. Before stepping into the area lit by the ship's hanging lanterns, Crozier steps behind a 10-foot-tall serac and pulls Silence in behind him.
Ahoy the ship!
He bellows in his loudest dockyard commanding voice. A shotgun roars, and a serac 5 feet from Crozier splinters into a shower of ice chips, catching the lantern's dim glow.
Avast that! God damn your blind eyes, you fucking loving idle-brained shit for wits idiot!
Roars Crozier. There is a commotion on Erebus's deck as some officer wrestles the shotgun away from the shit-for-wits idiot sentinel.
All right, Crozier says to the cowering Eskimo girl. We can go now.
He stops, and not just because Lady Silence is not following him out into the light. He can see her face by the reflected glow, and she is smiling. Those full lips that never move are curling up ever so slightly. Smiling. As if she had understood and enjoyed his outburst. But before Crozier can confirm that the smile is real, Silence backs into the shadows of the ice jumble and is gone. Crozier shakes his head. If the crazy woman wants to freeze out here, let her. He has business with Captain Fitzjames and then a long walk home in the dark before he can sleep. Tiredly, realizing that he's not felt his feet for the past half hour at least, Crozier stumps his way up the ramp of dirty ice and snow toward the deck of the dead Sir John's broken flagship.